Thank you, Dean Phillips. Dean Phillips is most kind. He is my older brother in the law and in the faith and in so many ways, and an encourager. W stands for William. Sounds pretentious. They put it on the book because they figured legally, generally, lawyers will use a middle initial so that you can distinguish one lawyer from another. The law firm where I went to work in 1984 when I got out of law school required us to do so. And I've always gone by my middle name, Mark. And so I didn't have a middle initial to put in there. I thought about making one up. I thought, like, okay, you know, Mark OK Lanier would be really cool. But decided to go with honesty, and so I used my first initial, William, and it seems to stick periodically. I don't know why IVP put it on the book, except that's the way I'm listed. It's an honor to get to be here. I'm really excited to get to share with you about this. I do have a copy of the book for you. We've got the book. They've just published it in Korean, so I am told. I don't speak or read Korean, and it's very possible that that might actually say things like, this is a joke, this is not a real book, open it up for various riddles of life or something. I don't know, but I'm told that it's accurate. I'll also let you know the book is being published right now in, what's the language where Dubrovnik, Croatian. It's being published in Croatian, as bizarre as that is. Hey, wow. The Kings are here from Lubbock. John and Elaine King. I feel like I've got so many friends throughout here. I've got Denise Carnes here on the third. I haven't seen her since a high school mission trip. It's just like stunning. And so it's good to see all of you, and I'm honored you're in here. I've got copies of the book to give you. Don't tell IVP. But if you want a copy, there's one on the way out. I've got some up here. I'd be delighted for you to have a copy. I want to talk to you about it over the next 3 days. I'll be giving you some insights in the book. I'll be giving you some insights not in the book, and we'll talk about it in some more detail than beyond the book. The book starts with a conversation that I had with a lawyer named Vic. Now, I do try cases. I am a trial lawyer. It is what I do. It's what I've done for 30-plus years, and I do it all over the country. And we've had some good success. We hit earlier this year a verdict for $502 million, hit a verdict a few years ago for $9 billion. I've got a couple hundred million in this, that, and the other. And in legal circles, that's a big deal. To us in the real world, with the Lord looking down upon us, the only big deal is, are we doing what He wants us to do? The only big deal in law is, am I pursuing justice and mercy? But in the cold, cruel world of shark-infested lawyer waters where I swim, that's a huge deal. Because there's no other lawyer out there right now that's got that win-loss record. And the stunning part is, people come to me and they think my entire life must be the law. And they have no clue. Y'all come on in, just make yourselves at home. They have no clue that I just practice law to pay the bills so that I can do this kind of stuff and have the joy of getting to do this and hand out books instead of sell them. And so it's an honor to get to do it. But as a result, I get asked to come speak at legal seminars all over the world. And when I'm there, weird things can happen. So I was in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'd been asked to keynote a seminar in Scottsdale, a lawyer seminar. And it was a tough thing for me to fit into my schedule, but I was able to fit it in. But here's what it involved. So Sunday, I taught my class, went to family lunch, went to the airport, and flew to Chicago. I had my team already on the ground in Chicago because Monday morning I had to take what's called a deposition. Now, a deposition in the law is where you take a witness. We had a video camera, actually three video cameras set up. And the witness, there's a court reporter, and all of the lawyers are present. Everybody's there but the judge and the jury. And the goal behind a deposition is you take testimony on tape, or digital, I guess, now. But you take testimony that you can then edit and you play in the trial itself. because the witnesses can't all come to trial. So I'm there, and I got to get ready for the deposition. It's a pretty big deposition, pretty important case. In fact, it's the case we tried this year that we hit the $500 million on. And so I'm there to take the deposition starting Monday morning at 8 o'clock in Chicago. I arrive. I set the deposition for the airport at O'Hare so that I can get in and get out. I land probably 3 or so, maybe 3:30 in the afternoon. And I spend the whole evening with my team. I've got about 10 people there, and I'm working them. And this. Finally, about midnight, I get to go to sleep because my team can stay up and get everything ready for me the next morning. I get up at about 5. I get what they've spent all night working on. I get ready. 8 o'clock comes. It's go time. I take the deposition. As soon as the deposition is over, it ends around noon, I head straight back to the airport, get on a plane to Scottsdale because I have to make a presentation that afternoon in Scottsdale, Arizona, that early evening. So we go to Scottsdale. I make the presentation. I tell everybody at the end of the presentation, I'd love to talk to y'all, but I can't. I've got to hit the road. I have a hearing in the morning in Orange County in the runaway Toyota cases. Remember, the Toyota calls it unintended acceleration, and I'm on the opposite side, so I think that sounds silly. So I call it Toyota's Gone Wild. So it was the Toyota's Gone Wild case, and I said, I have a hearing. Now, you gotta learn this law term for a moment. There is a law term called Daubert, or they'll say Daubert if they want to act French, or they'll say Daubert if they're from Texas. But there's this Daubert case that says the following. The judge is the gatekeeper in a courtroom for evidence. Judge can't let just anything come in under the name of evidence. The judge has to be very careful and make sure it's legitimate before it comes in. That's especially important if you're presenting expert testimony, because you can generally pay someone to say just about anything you want them to say. I can hire an expert who will swear under oath the earth is flat if I pay him enough money. And so recognizing that, the judicial system has built in a safeguard that says before someone's allowed to come in and say any cockamamie thing they want, the judge has a responsibility to hold a Daubert hearing. It's got that weird name because it comes out of a Supreme Court case, and that was the name of the petitioner in the case. A Daubert hearing that says, is there a legitimate reason to allow this in? Is it junk science or does it make sense? Does it pass the smell test? Is there any reasonable, rational reason for believing in it? So I told everybody at the Scottsdale event, I said, look, I'll be back tomorrow night. I'll speak again tomorrow night at the keynote over dinner. But I've got to leave right now because I've got a Daubert hearing in the morning in the Toyota's Gone Wild case. So I finish that speech. I go straight to the airport. I fly to Orange County. I get to the hotel where we've got the war room set up. And I've already got my team, advanced team for that case there. And we spend till about 2 in the morning getting ready for the hearing. And I'm running on fumes at this point. I've had, you know, I think about 4.5 hours sleep in the last 48 plus. And so I'm running on fumes, but that's okay. This is what we do. And so I crash about 2 in the morning. I get up around 6 in the morning to finish up everything, get to court, go in. The judge has this Daubert hearing where we argue until like 2 in the afternoon or something. Then we're finally done. I got to hustle back to Scottsdale, but first the team wants to have a meeting to discuss where we go from there. So we go into the federal courthouse cafeteria where I'm guzzling Diet Coke trying to stay alive, and we get back. I show up to Scottsdale, Arizona. I make the presentation, and then I'm thinking, finally, Lord, you're going to allow me to go to my room and get some sleep. Not too much, because I have 3 presentations the next day that I have to make, and I got to get back to my room and work on the PowerPoints for them. So I'm just absolutely worn out. I'm fried. I'm ready to drop, and I'm trying to gauge my exit. This is the actual place. I'm trying to gauge my exit down there where I run into as few people as possible so that I can get to my room and get some sleep and get done. Now, a lawyer named Vic from Seattle comes up to me and says, "Hi, I'm Vic. I'm a lawyer from Seattle." I said, "Hello, Vic. I'm Mark. I'm a lawyer from..." "Well, I know who you are. Last night after you did your presentation, when you left to go do your Daubert hearing, I Googled you." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I saw your website." I said, that's great. You know, we got people who put that together, and they do a good job. I hope you enjoyed it." And he says, no, I'm not talking about your law website." He says, "You're a Christian." And I said, "I am." He says, "I saw your Christian website." I said, "Oh, well, that's good. We've got a lot of people who put a lot of work into that, and I'm glad you're able to see it and all." He says, "Well, I've got a question for you." He says, "I'm an atheist." And I said, "Wow, that takes a lot of faith." And... because I'm convinced it does. And he said to me, he said, "Give me your Daubert hearing on the existence of God." I got to tell you, I was worn out. All I wanted to do was get some sleep. But something happens where, praise God, this switch just goes and gets turned. And I have absolutely no memory of being tired at all. All I could think about was how exciting this opportunity is. And I said to him, I said, "Vic, I would be delighted to give you my Daubert hearing on God." I said, "Let's pull up a chair." And we take the chairs that were at the table and we turned, I turned mine around. Only then did I recognize that there were like 7, 8 or so people with him that were interested in this as well, because they all grabbed chairs and turned them around. And so we sat there. And I've written this up in the introduction, because when I got back to the room, I was so buzzed about it, I thought, this is the introduction to the book. And I typed it out. So I'm giving you it based on memory. If it reads any different in detail here, go with this. This was more recent and closer to the event. But in my memory, there were 8 or so people. Maybe there were 9. And they were an interesting group. I said, "Okay, first I need to know where y'all are from." And not physically, but I mean, where do you land on this issue? So I know Vic's an atheist. I said, "Well, what about you?" And each of them went around in the circle, and we had some that were atheists. We had some that were Jewish by birth, but atheist by faith. We had a couple that were agnostic. We had one lady who said she was a Christian, but I think her concept of that may have been very different than mine. And I'm not a judge, but it was one of those things where you just kind of think, well, that's kind of neat, I think, maybe, I don't know. And then we had a crystal woman who was real into crystals and that kind of stuff. And then the last one was this fellow named Mike, a lawyer out of Ohio, sitting to my right at this point, and he says, "I'm a golden rule atheist." I looked at him and I said, "A what?" And he says, "I'm a golden rule atheist." Now, I started talking to him, my golden rule atheist. Hold on, there we go. My golden rule atheist. And I said, "I want to talk to you. But I said, if I'm going to discuss with you the existence of God as a Daubert hearing, the first thing I need to do is make sure you and I are on the same page for what it means to prove God." Now, we all grow up in a scientific world. Even those of us who are not science geeks. We take math in high school and before. We take science classes. We understand some basics of chemistry. I can say, Dean Phillips, if I wanted to measure the distance between me and Dean Phillips, I could guess it. I could say he is about 1, 2, 3, I'd say about 7, 8, maybe 9 feet away from me. Now, that's legit, right? I may be right, I may be wrong, but you understand what I'm saying when I say that, because we know what measurements are. But if I wanted to tell you, let's measure the temperature in this room. Well, we couldn't say, I'm thinking it's about maybe 15 feet. You don't use feet to measure temperature. You use degrees, Fahrenheit, centigrade, whichever you want. If I was to talk about how much liquid is in a bottle of water that I'll drink later. Yeah, there you go. Look, how much liquid is in this gentleman's bottle of water? Well, you don't want to say about 72 degrees because you don't use degrees for liquid. We use different measuring sticks depending upon what we're trying to measure, right? Okay. You do not prove the existence of God by using science measuring concepts any more than you measure the distance between me and Dean Phillips by gallons. It's the wrong measuring stick. And we know this in court. There's nobody in court that ever is required to prove anything to a certainty. It cannot be done. Even in science, you're generally going to have some confidence interval or some margin of error. But for some reason, we get tricked into thinking that faith in God is something that we are to be certain of in an absolute certainty sense. And that's wrong. Nothing is proven that way. I'm in a dialogue right now that I'll share with y'all maybe in session two or three a little bit more on, but with a chemist in Canada who read my book. And we've been emailing back and forth, and he refuses to accept that there's a God because I can't prove it with the same scientific certainty that he can prove whether something's an acid or a base. And I said to him, his name's also Mark, I said, Mark, that's the wrong measurement. You don't measure things that way. I can't prove anything. I said, do you love anybody? And he says, yes. I said, who do you love? He says, I love my kids. I said, prove it. You can't prove you love someone by scientific certainty. You have to prove it by how you act, by what you do. But even still, you can't prove it. You can't prove. So here's what happens. In a courtroom, I'm required to prove something by what's called the burden of proof. And what you do is you put things in a scale. And the jury's instructed this. You weigh the evidence. You establish its credibility. And the question is, what's the greater weight of credible evidence? What's more likely than not? And based upon that burden of proof, you can prove things. Now, if we're in a criminal case, the defendant doesn't put on a case unless they choose to. So the state, to prove a criminal guilty, has to do it beyond a reasonable doubt. But that doesn't mean there can't be doubts. So I'm not going to be able to sit here and prove the existence of God using science any more than I can prove the distance to Dean Phillips using gallons. But I can prove it the same way I can prove whether someone killed someone, who ran a red light, whether Vioxx causes a heart attack, whether DePuy Pinnacle metal-on-metal hips are bad and a defective design, whether they've caused someone to suffer damage to their muscles. I can prove things using the right measure of proof, and that's what we have to do. So I went through that with my friends, and I said, so now, golden rule atheist. Here's my problem with you. You hadn't thought this through. And he said, what do you mean? I said, too many people live this life and they take the philosophy that they like instead of the philosophy that makes the most sense. Because you want to take that burden of proof and you want to use it to see what makes the most sense. Let's take into account all of the evidence we've got. And let's see if we can come up with a coherent worldview or a coherent perspective or a coherent story that explains all of the different evidence we've got before us. That's really what we're about in life. That's what I'm about in a courtroom. I want to take all of the evidence and put it into one coherent story so that we know what happened. If I've got a puzzle and I want to put the puzzle together, generally you're supposed to use all of the pieces. And you're not allowed, in the laws of puzzletry, you're not allowed to take the scissors out and start cutting a piece because you really want that piece to fit and it doesn't fit, so you're just going to reshape it and put it in. That offends the sense of puzzlement. We're not allowed to do that. So in this puzzle we call life, instead of just taking the opinions that we hold and trying to wedge them into our argument because they are what we like, I said, let me suggest that what we need to do is take into account all of the evidence and see what makes the most sense and change our opinions to fit the evidence. Well, they can't argue that. I mean, that's pretty logical, right? That's a pretty fair approach. So they're okay. So I said, now, golden rule atheist, that makes no sense. I believe that human beings are hardwired, to use a computer term, for morality. I believe that as God made us, He made us where our essence understands the difference between right and wrong. We are hardwired because we're made in the image of a moral God. And so that God has a morality about Him that is imprinted into the essence of who we are and how we think. I said to Mike, I said, you believe in the golden rule because you're hardwired to it. And you know in your core it makes sense. I said, but if you're an atheist, you got no business believing in the golden rule. Your life itself is inconsistent with the philosophy you're taking. Your life itself runs contrary to the perspective of the world you claim is true. You do not live consistent with what you believe to be reality. And he said, oh, I do. I think the golden rule is built into nature. I said, Mike, what channel do you watch on TV? He said, what do you mean? I said, do you never watch Shark Week? And he said, well, yeah. I said, which shark lives by the golden rule? Hey, swimming through the ocean, I see a fish. I could eat him, but I don't want to be eaten, so I won't eat the fish. I'll let him go in peace while I find some seaweed to munch on. I said, where's that happening? We live in a dog-eat-dog world. This is survival of the fittest. This is a world where you trample on people to get ahead. Well, I don't think that that's right. I said, I understand you don't, because God made you and He's hardwired you with this morality. But if you're an atheist, look, if all we are is a sack of chemicals, if that's it, if we're fish plus time, and there's nothing beyond that, where do you get off with the golden rule? And I looked around the circle. I said, come on, there are 8 or 9 of y'all. How many of y'all believe that Mike's right? And they were all, I mean, all these my atheist lawyer buddies, they're all, yeah, Mike, no, it's not golden rule, man. We'll stomp on you if we can get ahead. Sorry, bud. You know, we'll don't turn your back. We'll knife you. You know, I mean, that's just, they were a little more honest about it. And he was like, what? And I said, Mike, I said, let me tell you something else. I said, all of you believe because you're hardwired this way. All of you believe that there's something unique, special, worthy of dignity and honor about the human being. Now, I believe that because I believe God made us in our image, in His image. And I have a fundamental reason for believing that we all think humanity is unique and special. I said, y'all got no basis for that.
Well, we think evolution put it into us so that the species would survive better.
I said, hey, come on. Where do you get that from? Have you read what happened with Hitler and the Third Reich? This isn't about, oh, humanity just survives better. Well, you know, I think we treat all animals with dignity. And I looked at Mike, and this is my golden rule atheist who said that too. I said, Mike, what did you have for dinner? Oh, I had the steak. I said, do you eat grandma? He said, well, what? I said, is your grandmother alive? Well, no. When did she die? A year ago. I said, did y'all feast upon her flesh once she was gone? Well, of course not. I said, why not? Well, that's my grandma. I said, well, wouldn't your grandma want her body not to go to waste? I mean, that's a lot of very nourishing protein. You got some minerals and calcium in those bones. I said, the reason you don't eat grandma is because you see there's a value and a dignity in humanity apart from the rest of the animals. And one of the, I think it was my crystal lady, she said, well, I'm a vegetarian. And I said, that's marvelous. That's great. I said, I'll argue with you on a different point. But anybody who's not a vegetarian, I'll argue this point. So we had a lot of fun, and I'm convinced that the general perspective is, by the way, I got to tell you, the end so let me just evolve. See, some of you may never come back, but I do this again tomorrow morning, and so we're just going to take our time and go through some of this stuff. I got 14 more minutes this morning, and I'm not going to get through as much as I'd like, but that's okay. We'll talk about something else tomorrow. So let me tell you what happened. So, when you are in law school, you taught evidence, didn't you? Or is that you taught contracts? It's a figment of my imagination. You take evidence as one of the required classes of law school. And in evidence, you're taught about two fundamental kinds of evidence. There's direct evidence, and there's circumstantial evidence. Now, in a courtroom, both are valid. In fact, juries are instructed, you must give credibility to circumstantial evidence because a lot of jurors just automatically think, well, that must be a second class of evidence. No, no, no. Let me explain the difference with a classic model you would use in law school. Direct evidence. I go outside and it's raining, and the rain is pelting me in the face. I can look up in the sky and I can say, it is raining. And I know that by direct evidence. I'm experiencing it. Got it? That's direct. Or I could be in my house and I could hear peals of thunder. I could see flashes of lightning through the window. I could hear the rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat on the window panes and on the roof. I could see my wife or my kids coming in, or friends, shaking off wet umbrellas with wet on their clothes, wearing rain gear. And I could tell you, it's raining outside. Not because of direct evidence. I'm not out there in the rain, but the circumstances all tell me the reasonable conclusion is it's raining. Now, could there be a Hollywood movie producer set up outside my house, shooting the windows with a water hose and having speakers with peals of thunder and flashes of lightning from a light machine? Well, yeah, I guess. But I probably would have known about it. So reasonable, circumstantial evidence. So now, when I'm talking to my friends, I say, what we got to do is we got to look at the circumstances to decide whether or not our faith is reasonable. Is it reasonable to believe there's a God? I can explain why we have morality. I can explain why we see dignity in humans. I can explain why we have love and it's not just some chemical reaction. I can explain why we see beauty and it can transform us, as opposed to it simply being a different arrangement of molecules with no real meaning. I can explain those things because those are qualities and characteristics of the God who made us in His image. So it's natural and understandable. It is evidence to me such a God exists, because otherwise I've got to come up with the reasonable explanation for why I am hardwired thus. So we'll examine, could it be evolution that's just sort of evolved these qualities in me? If so, then there are some implications. We talk through those. Is it just the environment in which I grew up? If so, there are some implications, and we talk through those. Because all roads lead somewhere. And I want to know if this road's going to lead to something that I can live with consistently that makes sense of the world. You with me? So that's the approach that I use for this. And we've got to start out, because one of them said to me, in fact, it was Seattle Vic, who said to me, no, I can't buy that God stuff. This whole idea of God. And he started telling me about God. I said, where'd you get that from? He said, what do you mean? I said, that's not any God I know. And I'm amazed at how many of us, especially even in Christian churches, have a conception of God that's not fair to God. It's certainly not the biblical God. So I think one of the first things we've got to do is erase the whiteboard and talk about what God is not and some bad perceptions we may have of God. For example, God's not a morality cop. He's not your conscience. If we equate God to being our conscience, then we can justify the terrorists of 9/11 who flew the planes into the towers because by their own conscience they thought they were doing the right thing. I can tell you my conscience has allowed me to do some things that were not the right things. I can also tell you my conscience forbade me from doing some things that, looking back as I've grown as a person, I've realized there wasn't any problem with that at all. The conscience, God's not your conscience. We have a conscience, and we need to treat it right, and we need to pay attention to it, but it's not to be equated with God. By the same token, God is not just a supersized father. Now, we know of God as Father. Jesus of Nazareth taught us to pray, Our Father who art in heaven, Pater Hemon, Hoen Tois Urinois, in the Greek. He taught us to pray it, but that's not to be construed by us as God just being some supersized father. See, one of the problems of Christians in this sense is it makes us want to be infants. And when Jesus told us to in a sense, be like little children, he did not mean stay in spiritual diapers. He did not mean that we are not to grow before the Lord. The Lord seeks us to grow before Him. Paul writes about renewing your minds in the letter to the Romans. Even Luke 2:42 says Jesus grew in wisdom and stature before the Lord and man. And so God's not just some supersized father who cuddles us as an infant and lets us stay in spiritual diapers all of our lives. We're to be like children in the sense that we are to shun some of the pretense and the pride and the pomp of adulthood and grow into spiritual maturity, right? But as Paul told the Corinthians, don't thrive on milk, strive for meat. Is God an old man in the sky? Is he just some guy with a gray beard sitting in a rickety rocking chair that generally just, you know, lets the world go on? He gets kind of tired. You know, he was more active in his youth. You can read about him in the Bible. He seemed to dabble a bit more in human affairs when he was an energetic young god. But now it's just kind of like, let it go on. Periodically he takes an interest. I'm not going to let that happen. That would be a little too much fun. That's not a good image of God. It's not a right one. Is God the Force, with all due respect to Star Wars? Is God the God of many paths, Life of Pi? I'm working on a new series that I'll be teaching this summer at church. Why I'm not. And one of the two-week lessons will be why I'm not a Hindu. You know, is God just, yes, Christianity is one way to God, and there are lots of other ways. No, that's not the biblical God. Is God the God of strict perfection? By that I mean not, is God strictly perfect? Because he is. But does God require strict perfection of his children? Heavens, no. If he could require strict perfection and we could measure up, there's no need for Jesus. So we got to be real careful, because if we think God's a God of strict perfection and he requires it of us, we'll have a tendency to reduce the law and his requirements and his morality down to something we can do, which minimizes God and who he really is. Is God the escape God? You can read the Psalms, and the Psalms will talk about God being our refuge. Bob Dylan, you know, shelter from the storm. Is that God? Well, yes and no. God wants us in the midst of our travails and problems and crisis and difficulties in life. He wants us to come to him. He is our stronghold. He is our rock. He is our refuge. But not so that he can isolate us from the world and all of its problems. It's so he can build us up and strengthen us and send us back out there where he will accompany us to face the storms of life. If we've got this concept, if God's a loving God, then he would not let my parents die. Okay, my parents are going to die. I got news for you. Barring the Lord coming back, I am too. And this idea, well, if God's a loving God, he won't let me. Come on. Think that through. The escape God. That's not God. God didn't save Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from having to go into the fire. He went through the fire with them. Okay. All right. The God of good fortune? I mean, is God just going to make sure everything works? When Paul says, all things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose, Romans 8:28. Yeah, but that doesn't mean name it, claim it. You got enough faith, you'll get healed of your disease. You got enough faith, you'll have all the money you need. That's not the biblical God. God of our group, the club God. Hey, we're in the club. You go to which church? Ooh. God may save you, but basically you're hanging on to hell. Is God the removed supervisor? Where our problems on earth are just too... I mean, he's got this whole cosmic galaxy to deal with. He's not concerned over what I eat today. Have y'all tried the pancakes at Marmalade Cafe? I mean, is God not concerned because this whole thing's just too big for him to do? Secondhand God? Is God what we've learned about him through the media? No. Is God the God of personal grievance?
This is the person who thinks that God's the glorified kindergarten teacher who's supposed to make sure good is rewarded and bad is punished. And how dare God let something bad happen to me? What kind of God is there? If there's a God like that, I don't want to have anything to do with him. He let something bad happen to me. That's not the biblical God. Bad things happen. Is God a boring killjoy? You know, is it the Billy Joel, only the good have fun? I'd rather laugh with the sinners than die with the saints. Sinners have much more fun, only the good die young. No. Is God a funhouse mirror? By that I mean, is God someone who is what I want him to be? Do I get to think of what God should be? And that must be what he is. Just maybe distorted a little bit. But a reflection of what I want him to be. We got to be real careful. God for the elite? Are there the super spiritual people? No. God is who God claims to be. And the biblical view of God is where we have to start. And it's where the conversation with my friends had to be. It's where the conversation with anybody has to be. Because the question is, who actually is God? And if God is who he claims to be an infinite, personal, not a supercomputer, personal, moral God who made us in his image. He claims to be beyond our ability to understand in some ways, absent his revelation. He explains to us that he's one God, not three gods. And yet we see him and understand him as three persons. Not a good term. But it makes sense that we're going to have trouble understanding the God who really is the God. And we'll pick up there tomorrow. Thank you, guys. I hope to see you back. If you did not get a book, there are some back there. There are some here. They're free. Please take one. And I'm honored that you would invest 45 minutes of your time with me. God bless you all.